welcome to the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward and I'm director of Eastern Arc. This is the second of a mini series within the Eastern Arc podcasts, and it looks at the American election coming up on the 3rd of November and also the underlying politics behind it. We're covering quite a range of issues, from the underlying concerns of the voters for this election. We're looking also at the history that's shaping the current system. We're also looking at the different strategies that are going to be used by both of the parties. In order to discuss these issues, I've brought together three colleagues from across the Eastern Arc Universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent. Emma Long is a senior lecturer in American Studies in the School of Art, Media and American Studies at UEA. Her research focuses on the history of the US Constitution and the Supreme Court. She also has an interest in the interaction of religion and politics in American history. Royce Carroll is a professor in the School of Government at the University of Essex. His research focuses on democratic institutions and the role of representation in the policymaking process in the United States. Rubric Began is a lecturer in international relations in the School of Politics and IR at the University of Kent. His research interests are more in the area of US foreign policy, inter-American relations and international political economy. Not all of them are going to be involved in all three of the podcasts, and each of them is going to talk about issues from their perspective and with relevance to their particular research. In this episode, we're hearing from Royce for the first time, and he's going to be talking us through the Electoral College and the effect that has on the so-called swing states. Emma, who joined us in the first episode, is going to talk a little bit about the religious underpinnings of American society and how that has an effect on their politics. I started by asking Royce about the Electoral College system. What is it? How does it work? And why did it come about?
So what it entails is that president is elected by individual state delegations of electors, and the states assign those electors based on their own internal election. And as a result, the strategy is almost always built around that, even though coincidentally, those strategies usually build up into popular vote victories. So there's a lot of overlap in the way that that looks. But in fact, mostly candidates are trying very hard to put as much emphasis as possible on pivotal states, with the so-called swing states, then rather than on just trying to drive up popular vote numbers. In terms of the decisive outcome, most of the investment are really just focused on a few states. And in the case of the 2016 election, we saw a relatively rare but always hypothetical phenomenon of very small plurality victories across a quite large number of swing states, such that the total number of votes that actually carried the day was very, very small. Famously, only 77,000 necessary in order to obtain that Rust Belt set of Electoral College wins. Why does it exist in the first place? Well, chiefly because the nature of the U.S. Constitution is built around states as sovereign entities. There isn't a mechanism by which whole national population can turn its will into policy. It always works through state boundaries, including the way the Congress is made up. Each of that is designed by the states, the sections of the House, et cetera. So this is basically parallel with the other state-oriented elements of the Constitution, and it is intended to prevent highly populated centers from becoming the main focus of electoral accountability. I would say it does quite a good job at doing that, although it doesn't necessarily have the effect that it was once expected to, which was more related to the idea that smaller population states would get a greater emphasis. And of course, in the very early thoughts, this had mostly to do population disparities in slaveholding states versus non-slaveholding states. It has emerged to become is something that is basically a pretty arbitrary set of targeted states because of the emergence of such a fixed set of party preferences. And that has led to the phenomenon of red states and blue states since 2000, because the mass polarization that has occurred, which really is mass sorting, meaning that people are consistently voting for the same party if they have certain views and are distributed in such a way that states that are more rural are going to be dominantly Republican, states that are more urban are going to be dominantly Democrat. And the ones in between are the only ones that really have any sort of shot at having any influence in the outcome. And that has been the case for some time. Generally speaking, the current configuration of the party support is such that the Republicans get a considerable advantage out of the Electoral College. This is on the order of perhaps needing 3 points more than you would want for the Electoral College victory, just in order to have a very, very strong chance of guaranteeing there isn't a reversal. And I think perhaps most remarkably is that a bare popular vote majority almost certainly does not win the election. And that's probably the most important thing to remember, and something that is very important to consider when you think about these polls narrowing, that his polls have to be viewed in a slightly different frame than Trump's polls, because the real outcome is much more in his favor.
How many swing states are there?
There are at least 10 to 13, 14. Of course, the ones that are really being focused on are necessary ones to win that the Democrats lost in 2016 and were, from their perspective, shocking losses, the ones in the Rust Belt that were historically, although not solidly Democrat. And those are the ones that they want to make sure that they have back. And by those, I mean Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania in particular. And in that same category, there's Minnesota is probably being targeted pretty severely as well at this point. But there are other interesting cases. Georgia is being considered to be relevant this year. Kind of a similar story to Texas in that it's a new state to consider in that light, and thus the foundation for it is not so strong. But I think most likely we would really just start with the ones that are polling well with the Democrats right now and were close in 2016. And that would really just be the top 8 or so from that direction. So the ones I just mentioned, plus New Hampshire, Arizona, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. And after that, it's not so important to go deeper into potential Republican territory.
Is there any sense, any appetite for changing the system of the Electoral College to be more representative? It does seem a system that doesn't always represent what the popular feeling is. Is there any appetite for change?
There definitely is, but it's very much countered by the fact that the party that would have just benefited from it, their appetite tends to reduce just slightly in the aftermath of it. So it kind of depends on how you look at it. I would say actually that there's a lot of new philosophizing about how the Electoral College is actually a really important thing from the perspective of the Republican Party, their interest in changing anytime soon doesn't look very strong. Of course, there's lots of push from Democrats to do it because they dominate urban areas. They would become much more weighted in the federal elections if that were the case. It has to be considered that because the campaigns are focused on the Electoral College, the actual popular vote is really hard to read. The institution is designed to not reflect the popular will. The problem with it is that the concept behind it, I don't think, is ingrained culturally. And the overall discussion of the popular vote, which has been normalized, makes it very difficult for an Electoral College winner and popular vote loser to get past that issue.
As with the Electoral College, the role played by religion, and particularly Christianity, in American politics and elections can seem very confusing to outsiders. I asked Emma to give a bit of background on why faith and belief is such an important part in the American psyche.
I started off my research career looking at the Constitution and the separation of church and state and how that had played into the decisions by the Supreme Court, and therefore more broadly how that had shaped American society. And, you know, trying to explain to students or family members or friends how the US can say we've got separation of church and state when politicians are regularly talking about their faith is one of those discussions that comes up quite a lot. It's a really hard one to cover in an easy way, and it's partly because the history of religion in politics or religion in public life has in and of itself become deeply politicized. So the question over founder, you know, whether the framers religious, what position would they have taken on this particular issue? Did they support complete separation of church and state? Has kind of got bound up with contemporary debates about the place of religion in public life. So it's really hard as a historian who doesn't necessarily want to get involved in those political debates to say anything that doesn't then get co-opted into that. But I mean, religion has been a part of American society right from the start. It's there, you know, both for good and ill. It disappears. It's been on both sides of the issue. I mean, the obvious example, religion was a big part of the abolitionist movement, but it was also a big part of the push to retain slavery. It's a big part of the civil rights movement, but it was offered as a defense of maintaining segregation. What's happened over the years is that it's become deeply entangled with party politics. Abortion is the obvious example for that, where religious faith became deeply entangled with policy positions on sort of pro-life versus pro-choice, and that kind of era that people have referred to as the culture wars of the sort of from the 70s through the 80s. And it has by both sides been used as a tactic in politics. You know, all the studies suggest that faith of some kind, Christianity or otherwise, is a major part of American social and cultural life. The number of people who say in polls that they are religious even if they don't go to church, or they have a kind of spirituality even if they don't consider themselves to be adherents of a particular faith, that's there much more than it is in most of Western Europe. But there's also this element of certain aspects of faith have just become deeply entwined with politics. And so then when elections roll around and these issues are back on the table as policy issues, religion then gets dragged into it. And some people are happy for that to be the case. And then there are others who say, no, this is not what my faith is about. My faith isn't about politics. It might shape my position, but it's not for the parties to take that on and use it. So you see both of those, I think, in the campaigns, on both sides.
In an article in The Conversation, Emma pointed out that something like a quarter of Americans self-identify as evangelical. How did their involvement in party politics come about?
In terms of what we think of as contemporary engagement with politics, it really began in the late 1970s. So in 1976, when Carter was running for president, he was the first sort of self-declared born-again president. Evangelicals sort of thought that they'd got their person in the White House, someone who shared their religious views and their religious background. And then, of course, they were really incredibly disappointed in Carter's position on a whole range of political issues, from abortion to foreign policy. He gave, I forget exactly when it was, but he gave an interview, I think during the campaign, to Playboy magazine, which of course was a big no-no in terms of the sort of the moral implications of that. And so they were disappointed in him. But at the same time, you've got the rise of the secular conservative right, who were ultimately behind Reagan's success in 1980, looking to see how they could win the White House and win gubernatorial elections and more Senate and House seats. And they saw that this group was sort of disaffected and looking for a home, and they reached out. In a sense, both sides reached out to each other, seeing advantages to the connection from both sides. And so what you see really from that point is the growing partisan politics of the evangelical movement. So that's continued since Reagan's election, through Reagan and Bush, through the Clinton years and on. I mean, there is an evangelical left. It's small, but it's quite vocal, and they are much more interested in sort of social justice issues. So you find them speaking out against Trump's border policy and the dividing of families, and on issues of sort of racial justice and those kinds of things. So this connection between evangelicals and conservative politics isn't naturally inherent. It's been built over time on the back of particular political issues. but the widely quoted figure from the 2016 election is that 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump and the Republican Party. You see Trump really making a play for them and their votes, especially since there's been quite public divisions within the evangelical movement over whether to support Trump or not, given some of his policies.
Both structurally and culturally, America and American politics sometimes feel like a world away, and yet the effects of their system does have an impact on the global community. And it's important for all of us to understand where they're coming from and how these decisions are made. Next time we're going to look at both the Democratic and the Republican strategies for this campaign. But for now, I'd like to thank all of the participants in this mini-series. Emma Long of UEA, Royce Carroll of Essex, and Rubric Began of Kent. I'd also like to thank all of those who participated and made these podcasts possible, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin, who provided the music. And thanks to you for listening. I hope you can join me again next time when we discuss further research happening across Eastern Arc.